From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Mike Nichols talks about directing the new HBO adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit. The adaptation stars Emma Thompson as a professor with stage 4 ovarian cancer taking experimental high-dose chemotherapy. We'll also talk with Nichols about his early comedy work with Elaine May and his early movies. Nichols' films include Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Silkwood, Working Girl, The Birdcage, and Primary Colors. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a series of concerts by conductor Pierre Boulez and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. Boulez is about to take a year-long sabbatical from conducting. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Energy forecasters told the Senate today that consumers can expect higher energy prices this summer. They said gasoline prices are likely to climb to an average of $1.47 a gallon. In a hearing before the Senate Energy Committee, a panel of energy analysts said that California's energy shortages are likely to continue through the summer, and the New York City area could also experience shortages. The Boeing Corporation has announced plans to move corporate headquarters away from the Seattle area. Jason DeRose reports from member station KPLU in Seattle.
Community reaction to Boeing's announcement was swift. Washington Governor Gary Locke, as well as Seattle Mayor Paul Schell, voiced their shock and disappointment. Boeing Machinists Union President Mark Blondin says he and other officials were only notified 5 minutes prior to the announcement of Boeing's corporate move.
I think they owe it to the leadership of this community to share this kind of information with us up front and let us sit down and maybe ask us what can be done, ask the community what can be done for you to stay here.
Blondin says, however, that he's relieved Boeing's manufacturing operations will remain in the Seattle area, where the aerospace company has more than 78,000 employees. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Seattle.
A bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House has introduced legislation incorporating many of the faith-based initiatives proposed by President Bush. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The measure would allow programs sponsored by religious organizations to compete with other charitable groups for federal grants in areas such as housing, juvenile justice, and other social services. The measure also aims to increase donations to charity by giving all taxpayers, even those who don't itemize, a chance to take a charitable deduction on their tax returns. It also expands the charitable deduction to include the donation of food. A similar bill will be introduced in the Senate. The measures face hurdles from both ends of the political spectrum. Many on the left have constitutional questions about giving religious organizations federal funds. Some on the right fear groups with objectionable views, such as the Nation of Islam and the Church of Scientology, could wind up with federal dollars. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.
California energy managers say they should have enough power to avoid rolling blackouts today. Officials at the agency that controls the state's power grid say the two power plants are now back online after being shut down for repairs. They said they may have to put the state on a stage 2 power alert during the peak demand period this evening, but that's still not enough to trigger blackouts. On Monday and Tuesday, short supplies of electricity forced the operators to briefly cut power to consumers on a rotating basis. In stocks today, the Dow lost 234 points, or 2.4%, to close at 9,487 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The first crew of the International Space Station is back on Earth following almost 5 months in orbit. The Space Shuttle Discovery landed this morning with the station crew and 4 other astronauts on board. Pat Duggins reports from member station WMFE.
Astronaut Bill Shepard and cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev and Yuri Kutsenko are expected to take weeks recovering from their mission aboard the space station. Space crews suffer from a loss of bone and muscle mass due to extended periods in weightlessness. The lack of gravity affects their sense of balance as well. Upon landing, most astronauts ask for a hot shower and a cold beer. The shower stalls and the crew quarters have benches and warning signs telling a flight crew that standing under the stream of water can cause dizziness, though some astronauts dispute this. Space Shuttle Discovery landed this morning despite a weather forecast that looked bad close to landing time. Conditions improved suddenly, and the shuttle crew was given the go-ahead to come down. The winds remained strong as the spacecraft dropped toward the landing site. NASA says one wind gust was strong enough to violate safety rules, but by then, Discovery was already on final approach. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
Federal agriculture officials have seized a flock of sheep in Vermont because of the possibility that the animals could be infected with a variant of mad cow disease. The officials will truck the 234 sheep from Greensboro, Vermont, to a research station in Iowa. The animals will be slaughtered, and the researchers will examine their brain tissue. A lawyer for the owner of the sheep says there's no evidence that the sheep are infected, but the agriculture department says they may have been given infected feed before they were imported from Belgium in 1996. In stocks today, the NASDAQ Composite Index lost 27 points, or 1.4%. It closed at 1,830. Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit has been adapted into an HBO film directed by my guest, Mike Nichols. Nichols first became known in the late 50s for his improvisational comedy with Elaine May. He directed his first movie, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, in 1966. He went on to direct The Graduate, Catch-22, Carnal Knowledge, Silkwood, Working Girl, The Birdcage, and Primary Colors. The new adaptation of Wit premieres on HBO Saturday night. It stars Emma Thompson, who co-wrote the adaptation with Nichols. She plays a professor of 17th century poetry who is diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer, which is terminal. The play follows her from the diagnosis through her high-dose experimental chemotherapy. In this scene, she's sick from the chemo and is alone in an isolation unit within the hospital.
Do not forget that you are seeing the most interesting aspects of my tenure as an inpatient receiving experimental chemotherapy for advanced metastatic ovarian cancer. But as I am a scholar, I feel obliged to document what it is like here most of the time between the dramatic climaxes. In truth, it is like this. You cannot imagine how time can be so still. It hangs. It weighs. And yet there is so little of it. It goes so slowly. And yet it is so scarce. If I were writing this scene, it would last a full 15 minutes. I would lie here, and you would sit there. Not to worry. Brevity is the soul of wit. But if you think 8 months of cancer treatment is tedious for all of you, consider how it feels to play my part.
Many people who've seen Wit on stage talk about how it reminds them of the experience of someone they love who had cancer and chemotherapy. And I'm wondering if you had associations like that.
Oh, without question. You know, my mother died of cancer, and my wife and I had a very close friend who died very young of cancer last year, and we were there for all of it with him and his wife. And of course, the play strikes that note, and then also your own death. You know, it suggests that unavoidably.
Had you seen Wit on stage, and I'm wondering why you wanted to do a film adaptation of it?
Well, I wanted to do the film adaptation of it because Emma asked me if I wanted to, and then the moment she asked me, I saw it with her and thought it was a very good idea. I had seen it on stage and liked it very much, and it sort of scared me, too. And that was interesting when Emma said, what about us doing it? I can't shoot a movie unless I see it in some way, but this I saw very quickly.
Did you and Emma Thompson, during the filming of Wit, talk a lot about cancer or about death or the death of loved ones, or did you just go about doing the work?
B, you know, we really just figured out where we wanted to do scenes and whether we wanted to do them fast or slow or loud or soft. I mean, I'm oversimplifying, but it was very much about how we would do it. We talked, you know, in great detail in the beginning in our workshop and in our rehearsals about, things like feeling in control with people and losing control and having no, losing yourself when you're being rolled around in those hospitals and ignored, and the x-ray technician who never meets your eye and so forth. Those things were very important to us to nail. Those depersonalizing aspects of healthcare as it is right now. But our own relationship to death and those we know who have died, we told a few stories. We had a few grudges against doctors and told why. I told her I remembered my friend who died the year before. He and his wife, when he found out he could have no more chemo, he said to the doctor, "How long do I have?" And the doctor said, "Ugh, I hate it when people ask me that." And that, in some ways, was part of my inspiration for Wit altogether, that he really thought it was about, the doctor really thought it was about how he felt when somebody asked him that. But by and large, we just did what we had to do, get the scenes done.
Why did you get into directing? You started off as a performer, doing comedy. Why did you want to go behind the camera?
Well, I didn't want to stay a performer. I mean, it's not that it came up that much. I think that as a performer, I was something of a director. You know, there were two of us performing, and I was, you know, always bossing her around a little bit. But also, I never really was crazy about what performing brought out in me, more of the baby. And I feel like directing brings out the daddy in me to some extent. And I enjoy it more. I like it better.
In what way did acting bring about the baby in you?
Why did it? It's just something that happens to me. I just turn into a baby. You know, I say, shouldn't I have the other dressing room? And look, that light is out. And why don't we come first? And who's opening? And I just don't like the performer's baby impulses. And they come out plenty in me.
Whereas as the director, you have to be careful of all the other actors' egos and baby impulses, probably.
Well, that's right. Well, you're worrying about somebody else. You're thinking about somebody else, which is somehow more freeing and which I enjoy more. I don't like worrying, did they like me? Will they like me? I prefer worrying, will they like her? Will they like him? Will they like them?
You must have had your hands full with the first movie you directed, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Because starring in that was Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, who were two of, you know, perhaps the most, like, followed couple in the press and by the American public. And they had this tumultuous relationship. And the story is about people who prey on each other's neuroses and delusions. That must have been quite a job for a first-time director.
Well, I was lucky. They were very good friends of mine. Richard and I were very good friends. We'd been in the same alley. Our theaters were in the same alley when we were on Broadway in different shows. I was in Evening with Nichols and May, and he was in Camelot. And we'd become very close friends. And then I was just becoming a good friend of Elizabeth's. And I felt quite easy with them. And they were very sweet and wanted very much to make the movie as good as they could. And there was really only four of them, four actors, and they were wonderful to the other two actors, George Siegel and Sandy Dennis, and they were wonderful to me. And Richard had his difficult days, difficult for him first, but we waited for him in this way and that way, and that was the only problem that ever arose. I was extremely fond of them, and I thought they were doing very good work, and in a good way we enjoyed doing it. I mean, they would get down, they would get depressed. Sometimes she'd say she was tired of spitting at him, you know, and could we do something else for a while? She'd had 3 days of spitting at him. But by and large, they were a pleasure.
Let's just listen to a short scene from the film.
Stop it, Martha.
What do you want?
I wouldn't go on with this if I were you.
Oh, you wouldn't, would you? Well, you're not.
You've already sprung a leak about you know what.
What? What?
About the sprout, the little bugger, our son. If you start in on this other business, Martha, I warn you.
I stand warned.
Do we really have to go through all this?
So anyway, I married the SOB. I had it all planned out. First, he'd take over the history department. Then when Daddy retired, he'd take over the whole college, you know? That was the way it was supposed to be. Getting angry, baby, huh? That was the way it was supposed to be. All very simple. And Daddy thought it was a good idea, too, for a while. Until he started watching for a couple of years. Getting angrier? Until he watched for a couple of years and started thinking that maybe it wasn't such a good idea after all. That maybe Georgie boy didn't have the stuff. That maybe he didn't have it in him.
Stop it, Martha.
Like hell I will. You see, George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop. A great, big, fat flop.
Stop it, Martha.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary. Not on an associate professor's salary.
That's a scene of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, directed by my guest, Mike Nichols. It was his first film. The first film that he directed. You know, it's funny, as part of Nichols and May, you dealt a lot with neuroses in relationships, but not on this level of kind of grand neurosis, you know, the grand theatrical version of neurosis.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of continuing a theme, but in a completely different level for you.
Well, yes, I think that's right. But, you know, when I saw the play of Virginia Woolf, I was really knocked out by it. I thought and still think that it's a great play, and I felt I knew a lot about it when it came up as a movie to direct, because there's something about the way Albee went about it that was very familiar for somebody who'd gone to the University of Chicago and known certain people there who had difficult marriages and lived a certain kind of academic life. You know, the gag about academia is that why there's so much backbiting and viciousness in academia.
No, why?
Because the stakes are so low.
Right.
And that it, I had seen a certain amount of that at the university, and I really felt I understood it. And I think you're right. You know, Elaine May and I did neurotic couples, God knows, and here was one more.
Actually, maybe this would be a good time to hear an example of the kind of neurotic couple that you and Elaine May did. But this is not just neurotic, it's also neurotic with a lot of intellectual pretensions.
Yes, and this I know which one then.
This is a routine called Bach to Bach.
You know it very well.
Better than myself in some ways.
It's beautiful.
It has a fantastic peace.
Yes. It's serene. It has a kind of mathematical certainty that's almost sensual to me.
Yes, an order, a finality, finally.
Organization.
She plays it with just incredible clarity.
Yes, she does.
Yes, yes. I remember I used to have to sneak in my room to hear it when I was a kid. You know, my family was your usual, you know, dull bourgeois family, of course. And there was really very little else for me.
Yeah. I guess my story is the same. My family was middle class.
Yeah.
sure. Ordinary.
Yeah.
And there was no relating. There was proximity, but yeah. No relating.
Well, no, it can't be. The pressures are just incredible.
And of course, I had a great many difficulties, which I've been trying to resolve.
Yes, and I think you are. I mean, I haven't known you that long, but...
Yeah.
You know, when you consider the... Well, the ambivalence of the woman's role today...
Oh, it's incredibly ambivalent. It's so hard to resolve. It's so hard to acknowledge the fact that aggressiveness need not be hostile.
That's right, yes, no. Adler was no fool.
No. I always thought of him as a fool, but he said some good things.
Yes, no, I've reread him recently. There are insights there.
Yeah. Too many people think of Adler as a man who made mice neurotic.
No.
He was more.
Much more.
Much, much more.
Can you move over a little? I'm falling off the bed.
I'm sorry.
A great deal more.
Yes, yes, he was.
Mike Nichols, I don't think that's dated at all.
I don't know. Think that I agree with you. I don't think that things have changed. But how could those things change between men and women?
We'll talk more with Mike Nichols after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is director Mike Nichols. When we left off, we were talking about his early career doing comedy sketches with Elaine May. How did you start doing comedy about neurosis, Jewish mother, psychotherapy, intellectual pretensions? It really wasn't the regular stuff of comedy at the time.
Well, I think it was the regular stuff of where Elaine and I found ourselves on the south side of Chicago at the University of Chicago. I think that we, to some extent, our comedy was formed by our audience by improvising in front of the audience in front of which we did improvise. That is to say, there were the University of Chicago at that time had a certain neurotic cast to it to some of the people, and it was preoccupied to some extent with Freud and with 100 great books and with certain literary references that the audience encouraged us to explore and make a little bit of fun of, so that by the time we got to New York, we were very surprised that everybody in New York thought it was so funny. Because one of the great things about Chicago, I don't know if you know Chicago, but it's a wonderful city, and it's not, unlike New York, it's not driven by fashions and anything. You don't hear a thundering herd going past your window all the time to the new restaurant or the latest play or anything. Chicago goes about its business, and it enjoys what it enjoys, and then it goes home. So it's a great place to grow and to learn something because nobody makes a fuss. It's sort of like running with weights. But I think the answer to your question is that we were partly formed by that community.
I'm wondering if you and if Elaine May had experiences of your own with psychotherapy, because that's such a part of the humor.
Yes, at that time we did. I went to a therapist somewhere around there in Chicago, and I believe she did. And we, in fact, I remember now that I met a girl who told me that this young doctor had made a play for her and she turned him down. And it turned out to be my doctor. And it became a sort of campus story that I said, well, come on, let's go home. And she said, no, I couldn't possibly. And she said, I said, why? She said, because it would be, you know, the gold-plated proof. And I said, so do me a favor. And actually she did. And then I was able to tell my doctor when he came back from his vacation that girl that had turned him down had not turned me down. But we didn't. I loved it, of course. But we didn't get any further in my therapy.
This was, I think, the era when psychotherapy was pretty new for middle class people to have, and the whole idea of neurosis, I think, was a kind of new part of the vocabulary.
It wasn't new around me because, among other things, I'd gone to a series of progressive schools, and in these schools which I had attended, one of which is a block away from the studio in which I find myself, everybody was in therapy. The school encouraged it, and there was a school psychologist who was kept very busy. And it was very much part of the vocabulary. And most of the kids in this progressive school were in therapy, so that I was very familiar with it. It was all around me.
Well, doctors in general were a big subject for you in the era where you were doing comedy with Elaine May. You had a whole album of doctor sketches. Now, I think you were a pre-med student before going into theater and comedy, and your father, I believe, was a doctor.
My whole family was doctors, and indeed I was in pre-med before I dropped out and went into all this other stuff. And also, you know, doctors... For Elaine and I had a radio show. We were on monitor, it was called, all weekend, every weekend. I mean, we weren't there every weekend, but we taped things for it. It was on CBS, I think. And when you're improvising, you grab what's quickest and easiest and as a sort of skeleton, as a structure for whatever you're improvising. And doctor and patient was something we fell into very often. And I've always had a kind of questioning attitude toward doctors, maybe because of my family, although, you know, my family, the people in my family were and are good doctors, but neither Elaine nor I felt any particular reverence. It was more, in some ways, doctors and patients are funny because power relationships are funny. And, of course, the doctor has all the power in a patient relationship unless you really stir yourself to change things.
Mike Nichols will be back in the second half of the show. He directed a new film adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit. It premieres on HBO Saturday night. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Wisdom of Menopause, Creating Physical and Emotional Health and Healing During the Change by Dr. Christiane Northrup. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, fleeing Hitler's Germany at the age of 7 and coming to America, we continue our conversation with director Mike Nichols. Also, Lord Schwartz reviews a series of concerts conducted by Pierre Boulez. He's about to take a sabbatical from conducting.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with director Mike Nichols. His movies include Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, The Graduate, Working Girl, The Birdcage, and Primary Colors. He directed the new HBO adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit, which premieres Saturday night. The adaptation stars Emmett Thompson as a professor of 17th century poetry who has been diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer and is receiving experimental high-dose chemotherapy. When we left off, we were talking about Mike Nichols' early career doing comedy sketches with Elaine May. In the sketch that we just heard, both you and Elaine May complain about coming from the usual dull bourgeois family, the middle class kind of family. You weren't from the usual dull bourgeois family. I mean, your family had made quite attractive to get here. You were born in Berlin. You and your brother, when you were children, had to travel alone across the ocean to come here after Hitler's rise to power. Your father had already come here. And your mother, I think, was sick and had to stay behind. That's a pretty scary journey for a couple of boys to make on their own.
Well, it is, unless you're the little boy. You know, kids sort of accept whatever happens. For us, it was very exciting, a gigantic ship and nobody to tell us what to do. And sort of a nice, there was a stewardess meant to look after us who let us play or do, I don't even remember what we did, but we got to do what we wanted. It wasn't perceptibly scary to us, but you're absolutely right, it wasn't any bourgeois existence either. We weren't in any way middle class, Elaine or I. We were terribly poor, my family, when we got here, and when we'd been here for a while. My father eventually set up his practice and did fine, but you could never have called us, you know, a middle class family, nor Elaine's family, who were Jewish actors who traveled all over, mostly South America, that we were really not talking about ourselves when we were making those jokes.
You're talking about the people who you knew in Chicago.
Right. And sort of the way that people had begun to talk about being middle class, that it was something you were always a little ashamed of.
It seemed a little oppressive.
Oppressive, and you wanted to be special. You wanted to be a worker, a sufferer, somebody who had political aspirations, but middle class, bourgeois. I mean, look at the word bourgeois itself. It started out meaning simply middle class and then ended up pejorative as it came into our language from French.
How old were you when you came to the States?
7.
So you were 7, speaking, I think, no English.
No, not for the first couple of weeks. But, you know, again, kids learn it very, very fast. In a couple of weeks, I was speaking English in school.
Uh-huh. Because you seem like such a verbal person. I mean, you operate in such a verbal universe, and you've had to be so quick verbally all your life. It must have been hard, even if just for that early period when you couldn't communicate through language.
I actually remember not knowing certain words in English, but it went so fast, you know, that it was over in a minute, as it were. And I think I've always thought that sort of immigrant's ear, that the extra ear that tells you what else is happening aside from what people are saying, is a very useful thing. And it's a very interesting thing to have, because you do hear. Sometimes you hear things you wish you didn't, but sometimes, mostly, you hear very interesting and sometimes useful things. And I recognize it in other immigrants. You know, somebody like Dr. Kissinger, who was such a great negotiator, I could assume that immigrant's ear let him hear things that they weren't saying, and he had a special talent, which was to hear what you were thinking and give it back to you so that you would think that you were just like him. And then I assume he would begin to negotiate. And I think all that has to do with being the little kid listening very hard for what's really happening in this new place.
When you were doing your comedy improvisations, needless to say, you were improvising a lot. I'm wondering how sympathetic you are to improvising as a director. In Wit, for instance, did you encourage Emma Thompson or any of the other characters to improvise, or do you think that theater and movies aren't really the place for that?
I think that they are the place for it under certain circumstances. That is, I've always assumed that if you have a very good writer, as we did in Wit, as I have had in the theater and in movies, you've got to assume that a writer, you know, thinking about a line for somewhere between 6 months and 5 years is going to do better than an actor making it up on the spot, including a feeling of spontaneity. You know, that's what theater and film writing is about. On the other hand, sometimes when there are things missing that you can only improvise, I have scenes that are entirely improvised in most of my pictures, and they're not very wordy. You know, I think there's one in Working Girl where Harrison Ford and Melanie Griffith have breakfast in this tiny kitchen together, and it's not great literature, but you can tell that they love each other. And improvisation is very good for certain things like that and for certain moments. But by and large, when you've got a very good writer, I say trust him.
So in that scene in Working Girl, what happened in terms of the dialogue that reveals that they are now in love?
Well, it had more to do with drinking from each other's coffee cups and mm-hmm. taking a bite of each other's English muffin and something that the writer improvised, in fact, Kevin Wade, on the spot, which is that he gave her lunchbox to go to work for the first day with, had her pencils and had her sandwich. And it was about people loving each other, but the words were nothing. They were unimportant.
My guest is director Mike Nichols. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Nichols, and he directed the adaptation of Wit for HBO that will premiere Saturday. You mentioned that you lost your mother to cancer. How long ago was that?
That was in 1976.
Did any of the ways in which she behaved when she was sick surprise you? Did anything seem out of character or so crystallize what her essence was?
Absolutely. She was a person who didn't suffer things easily and did tend to complain. And we were all very touched and impressed and surprised by the fact in the last year when she certainly knew that she was going to die, that she was extremely courageous and changed in that respect absolutely. And indeed had her courage to hold to her during that toughest year. And we were very proud of her, and we all got very close to her through her courage.
How much did she confide in you about what she was feeling, both physically through the cancer, but also feeling in terms of facing imminent death? Did she want to protect you from all of that, or did she talk with you openly about it?
Well, both, really. That is to say, I mean, my brother and I were grown up, and I think I said 76 when I meant 86.
Oh, that's much more recent, yeah.
Yeah. She implied certain things, but she kept most of it to herself. In fact, I think that what she found was a kind of reserve about those things, and a kind of private place. And the more she, who had been such a complainer, the more reserved she was and the less she complained, of course, the more we all crowded around and worried about her and tried to take care of her and show that we loved her. And so The last year was extremely important for everyone in the family.
Did you feel that watching her death change your feelings at all about death? Did it make you any more or less afraid of it, or make you wonder any more about what happens after death? You know, if you became more of a nothing happens after death, or more religious and wondering about what happens after death?
I've never gotten very far with that question. I've just always assumed that everything just sort of stops. You know, I'm not one of the people who imagines heaven and hell and so forth. And I'm therefore more concerned with what the actual dying is like, and do you bring some courage to it, and can you say goodbye to people properly, and can you accept it and be glad of your life? I think we all do a kind of checking. What if it happened now? What if it happened tomorrow? Have I gotten enough done? Have I been okay? Have I been an okay person? All that kind of stock taking. But I don't go on to afterward. I've found that having children and children that I'm close to has made a real difference. In some weird way, you do feel that you're going to go on. They're going to carry on something for you. And my children's step-grandfather, my stepfather, died last year. And they've been very concerned that he not be forgotten, you know, and worried that nobody's talked or thought about him for a while now. Let's do that. They don't want him forgotten. And I agree with them. You know, it's nice when there's somebody around who remembers you.
You're obviously a very verbal person and a fine writer. When your mother was dying, or when your close friend was dying, did you feel like you had the words to say what you really wanted to say?
Yes, I don't think it's a time for a lot of words. I think it's time to be there. It's all about being there. You know, another friend of mine died some years ago and never spoke of it, and the doctor asked her on the last night, do you want to talk about it? And she said, my only chance is not to talk about it. And I completely understand that. When you're there and it's somebody's last day, hour, whatever, it's not about what anybody says at all. I think so much of real life is not about what anybody says. It's about what we do, and in the sense of somebody who's losing their life, it's about being there.
Of course, in theater, it has to be in part about what's being said. Like wit, for instance, is it's all monologue and dialogue. Not all, but I mean, it's so much about what's being said.
Yes, but even in wit, you know, which is in which things are said so beautifully and what's the word I want? Strictly. Towards the end, there isn't that much.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. It's less and less about formulations and syllogisms because they're for the living.
Well, Mike Nichols, I don't want to say goodbye without asking you first about one of the most famous shots in modern movies, in a movie that you directed, The Graduate. And the scene that this is from is the scene in which Mrs. Robinson, played by Anne Bancroft, is trying to seduce the young Dustin Hoffman, freshly out of college. And the shot that I'm referring to is just as he's saying, Mrs. Robinson, are you trying to seduce me? She has been sitting on a bar stool. She's wearing a fairly short skirt. And as if in answer to that question, she has, like, raised her legs a little bit and separated them. She's, like, bent one of her legs. And you shoot Dustin Hoffman through her spread legs, through that one bent leg. And that shot even became the shot used, or the image used, in the ad campaign.
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about coming up with that shot?
Well, it was all about, that scene was all about him being stalked by Mrs. Robinson, you know, and we talked about it being a jungle, and it was a jungle. There was all these plants in the Beverly Hills garden that was, you know, behind the glass that surrounded this sun porch, and we talked about her being the tiger in the jungle, and she had a striped dress on, and tiger-striped dress on, and it was all built to be a trap, a tender trap. And then I wanted to just to find a way to express the fact that she was being extremely provocative and that he was framed by that provocativeness and that it was making him sweat. And there was her leg, and it was up, and it seemed logical, you know, to shoot through the arch of that leg.
And did you try it many different ways before coming up with just the right shot?
No, we just did that one shot. I mean, there it was. Anne put her heel up on the bar stool, and there was this very nice little arch through which you could see Dustin very well. And I said, oh, good, let's come over here. I like this. So, you know, things that become famous in movies are a concatenation of so many things that are out of control that have to do with the theme and with the way the theme strikes a time and a moment and people in their unconscious, all sorts of things that we don't control. But the process of choosing the pieces, the beads for the necklace that eventually gets thrown into the flames on the funeral pyre, or that gets put on the princess as she's made into the queen, the process of making the beads, to try to abandon this metaphor as quickly as possible, is always the same. You know, you just look for the shot that most clearly expresses what's happening.
Well, Mike Nichols, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
May I ask you a question? What do you think of me?
What do you mean?
You've known me nearly all your life. You must have formed some opinion of me.
Well, I always thought that you were a very nice person.
Did you know I was an alcoholic?
What?
Did you know that?
Look, I think I should be going.
Sit down, Benjamin.
Mrs. Robinson, if you don't mind my saying so, this conversation is getting a little strange. Now, I'm sure that Mr. Robinson will be here any minute now.
No.
What?
My husband will be back quite late. He should be gone for several hours.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson, oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson, here we are. You got me into your house, you give me a drink, you put on music, now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
A scene from The Graduate, directed by Mike Nichols. Nichols directed the new film adaptation of the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Wit. It stars Emma Thompson and premieres Saturday night on HBO. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz on Pierre Boulez, who's about to take a sabbatical from conducting. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. One of the giants of modern music, Pierre Boulez, is about to take a year-long sabbatical from conducting to spend more time composing. When Boulez and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra played a weekend of concerts in New York, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was there.
I was invited to a rehearsal for a concert by the Ensemble Sospeso of music by Pierre Boulez. I asked one of the brilliant musicians what it was like rehearsing with Boulez. Everything he said makes sense, the young musician told me. It's extremely obvious he knew exactly what he was doing and hears exactly what he writes. He could be God or the devil. This rehearsal was in conjunction with the weekend of concerts Boulez was conducting at Carnegie Hall with the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. Boulez is surely the most important living musician with a hyphenated career, conductor-composer. Or is it composer-conductor? Which comes first? That's the question Boulez has been asking himself. Beginning in September, the septuagenarian conductor is taking a year off to compose. His work is difficult, but elegant. One piece called Sur and Seize, French for cuts, as in film or sound editing, which Boulez worked on from 1996 to 1998, just won what is probably the most prestigious award in music, the $200,000 Gravemeyer Prize. The music started out as a four-minute piano solo. Boulez expanded this germ into a hypnotic 45-minute fantasy for glittering sprays of glissandos and arpeggios on three pianos, three harps, and three sets of percussion instruments that can sound like bells, marimba, vibraphones, steel drum, glockenspiel. These real instruments seem to imitate the textures of electronic music, only here they sound more colorful, jazzier, moodier, and more erotic. As I've gotten to know Boulez's music better, I've discovered that, like his conducting, it has a deeply human side. On a marvelous new recording of Sur and Seize, Boulez leads nine players from the Ensemble Intercontemporain. Boulez, the conductor, also just happens to be at the very top of his form. He's been making astonishing new recordings with some of the world's greatest symphony orchestras, Cleveland, Chicago, the Berlin and Vienna Philharmonic. Last year, he played an extraordinary series of concerts at Carnegie Hall with the London Symphony, in which he programmed brand new pieces, including one of his own, along with masterpieces of late Romanticism and early Modernism, works that interest him as the seeds of contrasting aspects of contemporary music. This year, with the astounding and anachronistically still virtually all-male Vienna Philharmonic, The most recent work was Stravinsky's explosive post-World War II Symphony in Three Movements, which Boulez followed up with something I've never heard him do, an encore. Stravinsky's Circus Polka, commissioned by George Balanchine for his Dancing Baby Elephant ballet at Ringling Brothers, Barnum & Bailey. Boulez has a sly sense of humor. It was delicious to hear him in a mood of unbuttoned, practically inebriated hilarity. The biggest works were by Bruckner and Mahler, the Vienna Philharmonic's Chicken Soup. I was allowed to attend rehearsals, and it was fascinating to witness Boulez go over and over again a tiny phrase to get from these spectacular players the precise rhythmic articulation he was looking for. In Mahler's Third Symphony, he got the American boy choir to sound less like boy sopranos than like real boys imitating bells. On the podium, Boulez has an uncanny instinct for exactly what it takes for each note, each phrase, to sink in. The Mahler seemed to come not so much from the orchestra as from someplace inside my own body. I was so choked up by it, I could hardly speak. So transported to another world, I took a subway going in the wrong direction. Do I want to hear more new pieces by composer Pierre Boulez? Of course. Do I want him to give up conducting on this level, even for a year? What do you think?
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and directs the writing program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Megan Howell and Patty Leswing. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Folly, a novel by Laurie R. King, the author of A Darker Place. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how President George W. Bush compares with Governor George W. Bush. We talk with Ken Herman of the Austin American Statesman. He's in Washington covering the first 6 months of the Bush administration. He's been reporting on Texas politics since 1979. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.